Okay.
You know that the Mishnah tells us that several different tragedies befell the Jewish people on the 9th of Av, and Tisha B'Av, the most prominent among them, obviously the destruction of both the first and the second Beis HaMikdash. But various other tragedies happened as well, including tragedies after the days of the Mishnah. The Spanish Inquisition, you know, not the Inquisition per se, but the expulsion of the Jews from Spain was also on Tisha B'Av. World War I began on Tisha B'Av. So various other tragedies happened on Tisha B'Av also. But even those that did not are often marked on Tisha B'Av. In some of the kiddush this morning, a number of the kiddush this morning, that were recited focused on the Crusades. Crusades, that period, had nothing to do with Tisha B'Av. In fact, some of the kiddush specified the exact date that was being referred to. In the old kiddush, remember Rosenfeld, and the British from London, he has in the back the kiddush that are recited, I guess, in England, regarding the expulsion of Jews from England and various persecutions there. Again, nothing to do with Tisha B'Av, and it's become also practice in many shuls, my shul here as well, but aside kiddush in connection with the Holocaust, which also was not particular to Tisha B'Av. Again, World War I started on Tisha B'Av, and in a certain sense, World War II was just an extension of World War I. Okay, but still, it's not Tisha B'Av, the date per se, but the tragedies. And that's why for the last many years, I've given a class on Tisha B'Av afternoon, but some event in Jewish history, which you know, fits into the Tisha B'Av theme, although it may not have anything to do with Tisha B'Av per se. So, what I'd like to speak about this afternoon is the Tehran children, Yaldei Tehran, escaped from Hatali Tehran, escaped from the Holocaust. For those unfamiliar, you see a title about the Tehran children, so immediately we tend to think that it's something to do with Sephardic community, Sephardic children, children from the Middle East, or the so-called Oriental Jews, and so on, which is not the case. It's not the case. It has to do with Jews from Poland, from Eastern Europe. As you'll see, they landed up in Tehran. The short and long of it, just in a paragraph or two, during the height of the war, about 730, and we'll see the numbers are subject to some discussion, but approximately 730 refugee children, most of them aged 2 to 18, okay, arrived in Eretz Yisrael in the middle of the war. They were known as the Tehran children. They were Polish war refugees who were exiled to what was then called the Soviet Union, USSR, and eventually reached Eretz Yisrael after a grueling and horrific 3.5-year-long journey. Along the way, many people died of hunger and disease. Some of the children were ended up in orphanages along the way from Poland to Russia and then eventually to Iran. USSR allowed Polish refugees to find shelter in Iran, which was then under the British control of the British, which as the war went on, you know, of course, the Russian and Britain were allies. And so therefore, they allowed them to come in. And 1,000 Jewish orphans and about 800 adults left the USSR there. They came to Tehran, and together with the Jewish community of Tehran, the children were provided for until they eventually ended up in Eretz Yisrael. The last group of the so-called Tehran children arrived in Eretz Yisrael in Israel in 1943. That's in a nutshell what took place. The story itself begins with the beginning of World War I, September 1st, 1939. Germany invades Poland. World War II, September 1, 1939, Germany invades Poland, World War II begins, and at that point, well aware of what's coming for the Jews, many Jews flee, and many of them flee across Poland's eastern border into what was then called the Soviet Union. Okay, about 300,000 or so, and again, the numbers are not precise, different records, but it's approximately 300,000 Polish Jews fled eastward towards the Soviet Union. Now, at the time, at the beginning of the war, although the Jews felt they'd be safer there, Russia was an ally of the Germans. They had had a pact with Hitler and so on. And, the Russians were never good friends of the Jews. And so these Polish refugees were put into cattle cars, similar to the ones that the Nazis had used. And they were sent off to Siberia in the so-called Soviet gulags, okay, where they went through tremendous hardships. In 1941, June 22nd, Germany violated the non-aggression pact with Russia and invaded Russia. Turned out to be a mistake for Germany, not our issue right now, but known as Operation Barbarossa. And, of course, many more Polish Jews perished or were killed, leaving many Jewish children either dead or orphaned. Okay, so, but these Jews ended up, many of them in Siberia and other republics, Soviet republics, these little states, and many of them now are independent countries, in Central Asia. Along the journey, as I said, thousands of children lost their parents. And here are some records, a description of some of the children. We have books, okay, which were written originally in Polish and translated in English. And recent books are written about the Tehran children. If you're interested in the subject, you can certainly look online. There are a number of books, even some relatively recently published, There's a woman, Michal Dekla, I think his name, from Eretz Yisrael, who's a historian and has written about it. This original book was done by the Greenberg, which originally was written in Polish, and translated. Here are some of the accounts that he has in his book from the children. On Shabbat, the 2nd of September, father returned from shul very agitated and said that it appeared that the Germans were coming. Mother left everything on the oven, on the stove top, and packed. She gave my brother Meir, who was then 12, a small suitcase, and she gave me one package. All the Jews fled, except for some old people who were not able to travel. The route was packed with pedestrians carrying bundles on their shoulders and with wagons and cars. The next day, father rented a wagon for a large sum of money, but after a few hours of traveling, decided not to continue and told us to disembark. Okay? Father begged, it was the driver who told him to disembark. The father begged him to have mercy. My mother wept, but nothing helped. The driver, the farmer, pushed us out of the wagon and continued on his way. Father did not have the strength to carry the bed linen. He threw it along the wayside. Mother jettisoned her suitcase, and thus we arrived in Rzeszów, a city next to the border train for Jarosław. Again, a different city. That's one account. Another account. On Saturday night, we boarded a wagon with Grandpa and Grandma, uncles and aunts, and their children, 11 people in total. The way forward was blocked with carts, broken-down cars, and dead horses. The unheeded wails of the wounded could be heard on all sides. German planes swooped low and strafed people. We hid in ditches. Another account, the Germans ordered all the Jews to leave the town and announced that every Jew found there after 6 in the evening would be shot immediately. We hurried to get our belongings and we fled the town. So these are some of the eyewitness personal accounts of Jews who had to run away from Poland and headed eastward. Okay, so the Peron children, their families, they were basically Polish war refugees in the USSR. Okay, now, as you know, I might not know, Poland in effect ceased to exist as a country because Poland was split up between the Germans and the Russians. There was a country simply, Poland ceased to exist as a country. The USSR annexed the eastern part of the country and Germany occupied the west, which was the so-called Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. Okay, the Soviets did not want to maintain the war refugees living, the Jews, on their side of Poland. Okay, and the Jews lived on the eastern side of Poland too, but they moved them to the safe of Siberia and other remote locations. Now, eventually, when Germany violated the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, okay, 1941, so these refugees were freed, actually, and they fled south, they were freed from Siberia, and then fled south to more to Central Asia, still part of the USSR. Okay, now, but many of them were working, deported in Soviet war camps in Siberia. We don't have a lot of records from there, at least I was able to find, but certainly it wasn't a positive situation, and many, seems that by the summer of 1941, over half of the deportees died as a result of either harsh weather conditions, disease, starvation, cold, and so on. Now, the Peron children would escape from Poland to Russia after Germany conquered and set in 1939, lived in these other regions across the, across that part of the eastern part of the Soviet Union. There were about 300,000 such refugees, but in the beginning of 1940, the Soviet authorities wanted to get rid of some of these, of many of these people. Okay, again, they were sent to Siberia originally, a horrible journey, cattle cars, everything you mentioned, high mortality rate, many children, orphans, became orphans or died. It should be stressed that not only Jews, okay, there were about 1 million Christian Poles who were also deported at that same time, okay, to the same place after the Soviet campaign of mass arrest of Polish citizens. In other words, they didn't want to maintain these Jews and many Christians in that part of Poland and sent them to Siberia again, in the chaos, bombings, epidemics, it's war, starvation, dislocations, many Polish children were orphaned, Jewish and non-Jewish. Okay, here's again an eyewitness account there in eastern Russia. They sat me in a wagon and mother ran behind us. At night, the wagon turned to the side. In the morning, when I looked behind, my mother was no longer there. Another quote. Father and mother came down with dysentery. We sold our last shirts to hire a wagon and to bring them to the hospital, but the hospital refused to take them in. All of our pleading was in vain, and we had to return them home sick. They lay in the hut for 2 weeks and grew sicker by the day. Father died on Shabbat, and mother died 4 days later. We were left alone, my little sisters and I. I couldn't support them on my wages. We had nothing left to sell, and the three of us starved. Another quote, I didn't want to leave father, but I understood that I was a burden to him. Before I left, I gave him my clothes and blankets. At the moment of parting, we both cried a lot, and father told me, Father told me to be a good Jew and to never forget him. Another quote. I watched mother die and then father, both of them starved to death. We were seven brothers and sisters and only I survived. These are excerpts from that book. The book is called The Children of Zion. The English translation of it called The Children of Zion, The Path of the Agony of the Torah on Children by Henry Greenberg. It was published by Yad Vashem in Hebrew in 1995. If you want to look it up, you can access it. So this was a story that began with the declaration of World War I on September 1st, 1939, with all these Poles fleeing eastward into the Soviet Union, eventually ending up, again, Jews and non-Jews, about a million Christian Poles also, okay, who found refuge there. The Jewish children fled also. Most of them, as I say, lost their parents and had no one to stay with them in these harsh conditions. So as we mentioned before, on June 22nd, 1941, Nazi Germany attacked the USSR despite the non-aggression pact, and an amnesty was declared, as a result of which all Polish citizens were set free from the Gulag, like we mentioned before. And they moved south, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and all those other stans that are in the southern part of the Soviet Union. In August of 1941, the Soviet government released tens of thousands of Polish prisoners of war and allowed the creation of a Polish army on Soviet soil. Because now suddenly they were fighting the Germans, right? So they allowed the creation of a Polish army on Soviet soil. It was known as the Anders Army, named for its commander, General Władysław Anders. Okay? Now, meanwhile, after the German attack on the Soviet Union, British and Soviet troops jointly occupied Iran. And that's where the story of Iran comes in. In August 1941, they forced the abdication of the person who was then the Shah of Iran, Shah Reza Shah Pahlavi, who had maintained Iranian neutrality. They got rid of him in favor of his son, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. This new Shah was more cooperative with the Anglo-Soviet ally and facilitated the establishment of a major new center for British and U.S. supplies. They were allies of Russia now, to get through to Russia. They could not get British and United States supplies through, you know, the more regular route, or let's say from England to Russia, you go through Western Europe and Central Europe. But obviously that was where the Nazis had control, so they had to come in some other way. So now they can come in through Iran, at the bottom of the Soviet Union and so on. So this was facilitated by this new Shah, who, by the way, was the same Shah who was here always to remember the Khomeini and the revolution in 1979. I think it was 1979, right? He was deposed. That's the same Shah. Okay, you know, 30, close to 40 years later. Anyway, and therefore this army, the new Shah in India, 1979 was the Iranian Revolution, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, so he cooperated and created what's called this Persian Corridor, which was a critical passageway for American and British supplies to be given to their allies in Russia. Okay? Now the British were in command of the southern area of Iran, and that's where Jewish refugees began to come. Okay? And let's remember that Eretz Yisrael at that time was also under British control, so that's an important point. You know, British controlled the southern part of Iran, they also controlled Eretz Yisrael. Now, meanwhile, this General Władysław Anders, who was a Pole, had been freed from prison when they let them go, and he founded this Polish army in exile, and they attacked Germany and Italy, and then they went to the Middle East and so on. Anyway, in connection with that, the Soviet authorities allowed about 24,000 Polish citizens, including about 1,000 Jewish children, most of them orphans, and 800 Jewish adults, to come to that point in Iran. So by the end of 1941, the prime minister of the so-called Polish government in exile, again, Poland, with half Russia, half, there's an old joke about, the person who, in certain countries, in Europe, who were constantly under certain areas, and cities were constantly under somebody else's control, So actually somebody here in the shul told me that his grandfather lived in four different countries, never left the same house. He was in four different countries. That's a true story. But the joke is that a person is living in town, they come and make an announcement, we're now no longer under Russia, now we're under Germany. And the guy said, oh, good, because these Russian winters are just impossible. Anyway, this is the way it was. So they set up a Polish government in exile and somehow managed to convince Stalin to let, 25,000 soldiers to come to Iran to arm themselves, strengthen the British. Again, the British were allies to Stalin at that time. So again, about 1,000 orphan Jewish children were among those people who were allowed to come in. They came in trains from the Central Asian districts of the Soviet Union, and they came to the Caspian Sea. Those know the geography, the Caspian Sea, and they came to Iran. Okay, so they were allowed to be there. Actually, there was some question first because the Anders army questioned whether Jews were allowed to enlist, some Jews didn't enlist. Anyway, bottom line is Jews migrated. Many of these Jewish children ended up, in early 1942, they authorized the settlement of these 24,000 Poles into Iran in conjunction with an agreement with the Polish government in exile. It actually, the Jews wanted to get involved in bringing the Jewish children over, but at that time, and some Jewish agency representatives, so-called Aliyah Bet agents, you know, gone into Russia to find them, but it was a little bit complicated because, you know, some of these Jewish children were scattered around and, based on their experience, were afraid to tell people that were Jewish. Understandably, you know, they, who do you trust, and so on. So you imagine the children, the teenagers, having to make these types of decisions. But in any event, this transfer began in the spring of 1942 and went into the summer, and it's believed that about 116,000 Polish refugees and Andes Army personnel arrived in Iran. Let's remember that the original number authorized was 24,000, 25,000, okay, so this is at least four times the number of people. Okay, and among these civilians, okay, and the Jewish children were not fighting for the most part in this army unless they were, you know, older, but they were not. There were 1,000 Jewish children, most of them were orphans, and that's the group that became known as the Tehran children, because from the various orphanages and towns where they lived in the Soviet Union, they came from Central Soviet, you know, Central Asian communities of the Soviet Union to a port called Pahlavi, which is on the eastern shore of the Caspian Sea. Others went to a different place, and that was the agreement. And once in Tehran, the community established an orphanage for these children with the support of the Jewish community that was there. There were Jews already living in Iran. There were Sephardic Jews who lived in Iran. Okay, so from April to August 1944, in the spring to the end of the summer, these refugees were brought under an area that was under British control, and they were set up in an orphanage, which the Jewish agency, Emissary of Samaritan Israel, which is then not called Israel, was called Palestine, or Mandatory Palestine, because it was part of the British mandate. And actually, one of the orphanage directors was a woman by the name of Tzipora Shertok, who was the wife of Moshe Shertok. They changed the name to Moshe Sharet, who was the Prime Minister of Israel. We know about Ramat Sharet and so on. So Moshe Sharet later became the Prime Minister. This was his wife, who was in charge. Okay, the orphanage was run under not the best of conditions. Food was a problem, and you know, there were issues, obviously, that they had to confront. But at least they were safe. Okay, here is the heat, starvation, sicknesses, and abuse by fellow Poles. You know, I mentioned before, Christian Poles, they didn't make them friends of Jews just because they said some of the same faith. So here is a description from a man with the sign Emil, age 15, records his arrival in Pahlavi in northern Iran in August 1942, after they came first, before they went to the British area. In 40-plus degrees, that's, you know, Celsius, so over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, the first group leaves the ship dock, and after a half an hour sail, gets to the small port of Pahlavi. Difficult to transmit in writing the first impression. Each one of us feels as if he is born again. He's come to a place out of this world. The port's waters were littered with colorful boats. The surroundings were had mowed lawns and flower beds. Rows of impressive Chevrolets and Studebakers, the cars of the day, waiting for transfer. Everything seemed good and beautiful. Everyone smiling with the Persians and the Indian soldiers who gazed at the arrivals with pity. After we were on shore, hugs for everybody. As we passed through small towns, Persian kids tossed apples at the car. Everyone was awed by the look of luxurious stores where you can get everything you want, chocolate and other Western sweets, okay, they haven't had in a long time, okay, and most importantly, bread and buns made of white flour. No sign of lines for food. It was acted out of a fairy tale. The heart expands. That was the excitement that these kids felt, the 15-year-old felt at this time. Now, I'm just going to read you, because I want some quote. This woman, Dekel, I don't know if she's Israeli, I'm not sure, but you know, she's written a lot based on the experience of her father. I'm just going to read a summary of what she felt, or a record of her father's experience. The story of the Tehran children was that their journey took 3.5 years, from September 1939 to February 1943. We're not done with that part. We're done with 3.5 years. 1,277 days of daily battles for a piece of bread, and nearly 500 of those days spent without parents or other adult protectors. My father, Hanan Dekel, was 13 when the Nazis invaded Poland, and his sister, Rivka, was 8, their cousin only 6. They were provincial aristocracy of sorts that had a successful brewery business, and later I learned supplied beer to America during Prohibition. Okay. They escaped from Poland to Soviet-controlled territories in the days following the Nazi invasion, and we've covered this, was just a first-hand testimony, or a second-hand testimony. In March 1940, 6 months after they left, the Soviets presented them with a choice to either rescind their Polish citizenship for a Soviet one or immediately return to Poland. Some returned, others were boarded on cattle cars and shipped off in the opposite direction to the Siberian Gulag in the eastern Russian provinces. To there, they traveled for 3 weeks without food, with little water. In the Gulag, there were slave laborers, Siberian, cutting down the trees of the vast Serbian forests in deadly temperatures. At least a quarter of the Gulag inhabitants died there, if not on the way. But after 14 months, when Germany invaded the USSR, they were released under general amnesty to Polish citizens and decided to head south towards warmer Uzbekistan, walked in the snow for weeks, or traveling aboard cargo trains alongside troops of the newly formed army, that's the Andes army, which we mentioned before. In Tashkent, Uzbekistan, they joined the huge body of naked and starving refugees who were already there. In some ways, that was worse than the Gulag, okay? Because again, you know, for the refugees, the Uzbeki towns were full of sickness and still trouble in their own violence, no food, the heat, typhus, malaria, all these things, I'm skipping, you know. He said, scores of kids roamed the street on their own, including my father's cousin, Naomi, whom they came upon by accident. Nearing starvation, my grandparents decided to place the kids in one of the Christian Polish orphanages that had been set up over there. They were not always hospitable for Jewish kids, but they had food. Okay, and the streets outside were far worse. Okay, 6 months later, it was decided the troops of the Andes army, in the same army, who was stationed in Uzbekistan, we sent to Iran to strengthen British armies in the Middle East. And along with the troops, 11,000 Polish citizens were taken. Again, that wasn't part of the deal, but we mentioned before that, and eventually many, many more. Okay, and the Tehran children were among them. They raised, as we said before, from the age of 2 to 18. Okay, they sailed along the Caspian Sea for 2 hours and eventually arrived in the port cities we mentioned before. In Iran, they were safe for the first time, though still hungry and cold. They lived in Polish army tent camps on the outskirts of Tehran. Okay, the Jewish children, Polish children, and Polish Jewish children in particular, were at the bottom of the barrel. Okay, in terms of, you know, what you got and where you got to live and so on, at the bottom of the heap. Eventually, the Jewish Agency, which was, you know, a Zionist organization, obviously, that was operating in Tehran, more or less openly, but it was under British control, set up a separate Jewish camp. The Jewish Agency wanted to get the children to Palestine / Eretz Israel, but that was nearly impossible, because the British at that time, we've discussed this in the previous years, the British at that time refused to admit any refugees to Eretz Israel, to Palestine, during the war. And there was another plan to, you know, to take them across, you know, unofficially through Iraq, and then it was called Jordan, but Iraq refused at the last minute. There was another plan to fly them, and then all these plans kind of fell through. Here's a quote from a woman by the name of, she was from the director of the Aliyat Noah, her name was Henrietta Zolt, known as Hadassah. Quote, "In Tehran, there are 981 children from the ages of half a year to 17 years old. 80% of them arrived in Tehran without parents. Only 20%, approximately 220 of the children, came together with their parents. Not all the other children were orphans. However, at this moment, they are without parents. Perhaps later, some of these children will find their parents, or the parents will find them in Palestine. For this purpose, I have requested that in Tehran, the children will be photographed with their names so that their parents will recognize them if and when they arrive in Palestine, in spite of the changes in their facial appearance." I mean, you know, I haven't seen the kids. I mean, I can tell you now, nothing to do with the Tehran story, but my father's in Al-Rahul was separated from his parents in the war. He was in Vienna. He was born and raised in Vienna, and he was 4 years old. The war started. His parents put him on a train. He ended up in Holland. It's a story for a different time. But after the war was over, he had been living in Holland for most of the war. He was safe. He had his parents. In different ways, both survived the war. The details are not in today's presentation. But he told me, you know, one fine day, a British officer showed up and said, "I'm taking you to London to meet your parents." And he flew on his RAF Air Force plane. And, you know, his father picked up the airport, but neither of them recognized each other. He didn't recognize him. He thought he was 4 years old, and he was 12. And they didn't speak the same language. My father and then was speaking Dutch, and, you know, the Yiddish and German, he'd kind of forgotten or whatever. So, you know, he said, I remember telling him, he met his father yet, but he didn't recognize him. His father didn't recognize him either. So that was the plan that Henrietta Zolt said, let's take the pictures so that the parents were able to recognize. Anyway, so as part of this, you know, again, 1,800 Jews, again, the numbers vary from site to site in terms of the records, but there were orphans and so on, and there was an orphan set up, and the emissaries started to show, these Jewish agents, people started to, you know, to get involved, to bring these children who were often living in, you know, in not the best conditions, better than before, not the best conditions in Tehran, to bring them over to Eretz Israel. And they are, of course, the Jewish agency, an important point, or important contributor to the story of the Tehran children. Okay, the truth is that even while they were still in the Soviet Union, I mentioned before, Jewish agency representatives went as soon as permission was given for Jews to leave the Soviet Union to head to Iran, so they went around and so on, and Jewish agency represented them, and when they could, separated the Jews from the Christians and so on. Okay, but as I said before, many children refused to admit that they were Jewish, because, you know, they grew up for a while being frightened to admit that you were Jewish. Okay, but Once in Tehran, David Ben-Gurion and Eliel Dabkin, who were, you know, Zionist officials, they negotiated with the Polish cabinet minister. Again, it's the Polish government in exile. Polish cabinet minister named Stanislav Kot and other British officials to facilitate bringing those children to Eretz Yisrael, to Palestine. Okay? And it was a Jewish agency that helped establish that orphanage we mentioned before. Okay? They lived there, they said, in tents outside, and a number of different plans to bring them to Eretz Yisrael didn't work. Okay? But, and by the way, that camp where the Jews lived became known as the Tehran Home for Jewish Children, okay, which local Jewish communities supported, and organizations like Hadassah, a women's organization in the United States, and other organizations, the joint, what's called the joint, you know, the Joint Distribution Committee, and so on, Youth Immigration Department, now they have nowhere from the Jewish Agency, supported, and that's what helped these orphanage, you know, get food and so on and so forth. Now, experienced Zionist youth leaders from Eretz Yisrael came and took charge of, you know, educating the children. We'll get to that also, because there's going to be an unfortunate side to that. But in any event, most of the people orphaned. There were some adults, according to some rabbis and so on. Mostly the other people were elderly men and women. They identified the Jewish children. They kept them in that tent, in that so-called Tehran Home for Jewish Children, for a while. But the plan was to get them to come to Eretz Yisrael. Now, as I said before, the Iranian Jewish community and even the Iranian general community at first supported and helped. But let's recall that a war is going on. And after a while, when supplies grow scarce and the winter is coming, you're not so eager to have a lot of extra mouths to feed. Okay, that becomes a problem. Okay? These Jewish children, again, you know, originally were welcomed by the Iranian public, and you know, after a while they grew hostile, okay, especially after rising bread costs led in general to revolutions and protests in Iran itself, okay, and they referred to the Polish refugees, not specifically to the Jews, they referred to the Polish refugees as, quote, the parasites of the Allies. Okay, you know, again, you know, when things get tough and there's no food and you know, you're all of a sudden you don't want all these extra mouths. There were graffiti along, you know, walls and so on in Iran. All of Persia is hungry as it watches the Poles and the British eat their bread. So that doesn't foster, you know, foster good feelings. Okay. Now, again, as I mentioned, once the Jewish agency operated, opened, you know, that orphanage and got involved, so then they weren't, you know, sponging, so to speak, off of their Iranian public. So things got a little better. At least the Jewish orphanage, again, the Tzipora Sheretz, Moshe Sheretz's wife, was in charge, and so, you know, there were, and material support came from Jews. Jews always support other Jews, wherever they are. So that happened over here as well. And so therefore they covered their food, and also the Zionist organizations and the joint and so on and so forth were going to pay for them to get there to Israel, so there would be no burden on the Persians. Okay, I mentioned before that Ben-Gurion and Dabkin negotiated with the Polish authorities, and ultimately the British ambassador to the United States, Lord Halifax, granted in December of 1942, agreed and granted entry into Eretz Yisrael. The war's still going on. It's still full of the war, let's recall. Okay, granted entry to Eretz Yisrael for these children coming from Iran, these Tehran children. On January 3rd, 1943, 716 children, most of them orphans, left Tehran, a long and very circuitous route through Pakistan, in the other direction, to Egypt, the Sinai Desert, because again, as I said before, Iraq refused to allow them to come through there. Okay, so again, this was in January 43 when this agreement was reached between the British and the Egyptians, you know, and basically, overnight, without any preparation, you know, lefacha, out. Okay, I mean, the permission was granted, it could be taken away the next day just as fast. So you got the permission, you didn't, you know, you act quickly. Okay, so basically they went onto a British warship to Karachi, which is now Pakistan, as part of India. Now it's in Pakistan, the other direction. And from there they went on another warship from Karachi to Suez. Okay, again, you can picture the geography coming around, you know. And from Suez, they crossed the Sinai Desert by train. They stopped in El Arish, which is the northern part of the Sinai Peninsula. Finally, after nearly 4 years after having left Poland, okay, 3.5 years after Poland, they arrived in Atlit, which is a port city sort of between Haifa and Tel Aviv, closer to Haifa, on February 18, 1943. So that was 716 children. Okay, they traveled. You can imagine going from Iran to India/Pakistan, and coming down the Arabian Peninsula through the Red Sea to Suez. You know, imagine what the trip must have been like. However, when they arrived in Atlit, northern Eretz Yisrael, on February 18th, 1943, The Yishuv, the Jewish Yishuv, welcomed them with open arms. A number of months later, August 28, 1943, another group, a second group, 110 children arrived. So all in all, about 870 Tehran children arrived in Eretz Yisrael. It's the largest group of survivors to arrive in Eretz Yisrael during the war years. Again, the officials were not coming, and it's the largest group. Okay, upon arrival in Eretz Yisrael, they're greeted by Henry Edizol, you know, founder of Hadassah, and Youth Aliyah represented, and so on, and they were joyously welcomed. Okay, there was a newsreel, you know, the old newsreels, newsreel of these children arriving, local preschool children and nursery school children lined up with welcome signs and so on to, you know, to dance and flowers, you know, and banners in Hebrew to welcome these children. So this is how they landed up. Again, you know, malnutrition, illness, displacement, sickness, losing your parents, imagine what they went through. And again, it's somewhat of a forgotten part. You know, I don't think that many people know about this, and there hasn't been that much written about it. But again, this is what took place, and eventually they arrived in near Haifa, south of Haifa, in the city called Adli. So overall, okay, up to this point, it's a cheerful story, and everybody lives happily ever after, right? However, there is, and again, it speaks about Jews doing what has to be done to save other Jews, to bring them to Eretz Yisrael, the largest group of survivors who brought to Eretz Yisrael during the war years. It's something remarkable, and, you know, in that sense, the Jewish agency and the people who worked on it deserve tremendous credit for, I'm sure there were risks, I'm sure there were complications and so on, and they got these children eventually to Eretz Yisrael in 1943. However, there's a dark side, unfortunately, and you know, some may be familiar with this. The, you know, we talk about the kinnis on Tisha B'Av morning, so we speak about the Asura Hurriya Malchus, the so-called 10 martyrs. And the reason now, there's all kinds of literature about that. I think one year, many years ago, maybe I spoke about it. We won't talk about Tisha B'Av. Anyway, Asura Hurriya Malchus, that had also nothing to do with the Churban Beis HaMikdash directly. Okay, so these were Jewish leaders who were executed in terrible ways. The Kiva, the great, you know, we know about it in Yom Kippur also. Okay, in fact, the Piyut in Yom Kippur is more detailed than the one that we see on Tisha B'Av and the Kinnis. But anyway, what's it got to do? I mean, it's a terrible tragedy, don't get me wrong, what's it got to do with Tisha B'Av? So it's clear there are other things about it also, that other Kinnis have pointed in this direction also. The Romans understood very well, they realized very well, that even after you destroyed the Jewish temple, you destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, but the Jewish people survive. Okay, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, the Gemara tells us, made the famous deal, where he in effect surrendered Yerushalayim. He realized it was a losing battle. Okay, nothing's going to survive. So he surrendered Yerushalayim in exchange for certain things, including Yavne v'Chachamel, that the house of the Nasi should be spared, and we should be able to reconstitute Jewish leadership in another place. It won't be in Yerushalayim, in Yavne. And that's where they went. And so the Jews survived because the Torah was kept alive. And the Romans ultimately realized that. They thought, oh, we're going to destroy their temple, that's the end of their religion. Then they realized afterwards that that's not the key. The key is their Torah. So if we can get rid of their Torah leaders, okay, then we have a chance. Okay, this is what others have understood. That's why we find many times, and before the Romans, and certainly the Romans themselves, outlawed Torah study and more. That's why. Because they understood that that's what the key to our survival is. So here you have the physical survival of these Tehran children. However, it became a major problem because when they came into Eretz Yisrael, they became the subject of a major battle between the Mizrahi movement, who wanted the children to be educated in Zionist religious institutions, the Aguda, which they wanted them educated in Aguda and Haredi Yeshivas, and the secular leaders, who wanted them to be, you know, become centered, non-religious kibbutzim. The overwhelming majority of these children were from children, were Dati children. That's a reality, that's a fact. No one disputes it. But, you know, many of the people, I'm talking openly, many of the people who, the secular Jews, who are responsible in great measure for building up the state, were anti-Torah. They were. They envisioned something else in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, this is not the time for it, but the, you know, the objection in the among Rosh Yeshiva and you know, Yeshivish community to the establishment of the state of Israel, I'm not talking about today. I'm talking about, you know, when the state was established, they had legitimate concerns, let's put it that way. They had legitimate concerns. Because many of the secular Zionists openly wanted to get rid of Torah observance. This is not who we are anymore. We're a new people with our state. We're going to build it up, and it's going to be an agricultural center, an industrial center. Everyone's going to university, everyone's going to go here. Okay, this is what they wanted. And I'm not here to criticize anybody, because, you know, I mean, it was their blood that built the country too. But the fact is, this was a major issue, and some of the prominent rabbis we've all heard of, we've heard all of this, the objective of the state of Israel, okay, you know, it's 70 plus years later, I'm not analyzing the situation right now. But at that time, the concern for the future of Torah in Israel was a legitimate concern. It was a legitimate concern because of who was involved. Now, other people, we know, or Cook, I'm not analyzing that issue now. But those who objected to objected, they had reasons for objecting. And it played out, to some extent, with the Tehran children, because there was now a major question, would they, these were kids, most of which were from religious, from homes. And suddenly now, we're being educated and perhaps being sent to non-religious places where they were told, that's old-fashioned, we don't do that anymore, we're in our own country, that was good in exile. That's what they were told. There's a very fine book called The Fury Poured Out by Rabbi Bernard Mazer in Queens, okay? And he's a Talmud of Moshe Feinstein. Anyway, so he has a brief section of the on the Tehran children. So just some of the things that he records here were, you know, and he has Shomer HaTzair, which is a non-religious youth organization in Eretz Yisrael. They said, our goal must be, this is a direct quote, our goal must be to bring the children to understand that their belief in God has no logical or rational basis, and the religion is the product of reactionary government that has no right to exist in a new land where the people are endeavoring to establish a forward-looking modern nation. They said it unabashedly. That was their credo. Okay, and therefore they're going to appoint the madrichim, so to speak, for these children. We're going to be people who push that particular line. Okay, he has, on the morning of Rosh Hashanah, the children asked that Rosh Hashanah, and they refused. Okay, the meals served to the children were sometimes not kosher. Children who insisted on kosher food were admonished. Children who wanted to say kaddish to their parents were admonished. Okay, initially they were given a place to daven, but eventually that one was taken away. Okay, this is in the Hatzofer, the Israeli newspaper Hatzofer, March 7, 1943. Okay, report that the reporter wrote, he had an interview with the children in camp of Tehran. Okay, this is before they came to Israel. I think this was a group that before they came, or maybe that's just after they came. The main object of the leaders who guided the group was to guide the children for a new life in Palestine. The goals of life were hard work and the achievements of man's efforts. Dear children, they would say, we are going to land in Israel. You don't need your yarmulkes on your head anymore. So these were people, again, these of us to criticize, they had a different approach and so on. But that's why there was a significant battle. And again, these were children, most of them came from religious homes. Some of them very little, so what do they remember? But some of them were teenagers, and they had bar mitzvahs and everything else, and they remember, okay? Here's other stories. I'm not going to read every quote here. But in May 5th of 1943, a Mizrahi madrik, Yeshua Bachrach, who later wrote some sarm. Okay, then he used to talk about it, I still do. Anyway, so he wrote, what they did was when they came to Eretz Yisrael, so they took the kids, because the kids ultimately were going to choose where they want to live. So, okay, you stack the deck. You take them to the nicest kibbutzim, and you want to see a religious place? Yeah, dirty, dumpy, you know, nothing. Right, so that you're going to take them to see those kinds of things. So what's the kid going to choose? So Yeshua Bachrach wrote in May, it was in Hatzofet, May 5th, 1943, one of the famous excursions where children were taken on three-day trips, okay, after they'd been in the country only 6 days, tired from their wandering, come down with fever, without a legitimate educational tool. They may answer where they want to go, but whoever kept up with all the situations, all the talk that accompanied and hovered around the children can testify that an unforgivable wholesale crime was committed here, okay, in terms of educating and placing these children. Another article in Haderach, on Aguda Madrich, reported the victims fell daily. Many children began to forget the daven shacharis, and they did, you know, put on tefillin. Maybe sometimes they had the time, so there was definitely a movement basically to secularize these children. So you can imagine there was a major fight, and of course, among the religious parties didn't get along either. So Mizrahi and Aguda didn't get along either. They ultimately agreed they should have Jewish education. What should be the nature of Jewish education? Okay, they claimed, they both agreed that the Zionists were fostering atheism, okay, and spiritual annihilation. But ultimately, of the 716 children who arrived in February, 278, about 40% were sent to Mizrahi institutions. 32, or about 5%, were assigned to Aguda yeshivas, and the remainder, 55%, were assigned to mostly secular kibbutzim. Okay, both the Mizrahi and Aguda, one thing they agreed on was they were outraged by this distribution. They thought it wasn't fair given the background of the children. Okay, I mean there were plans even Aguda had to kidnap children, to all kinds of stuff. In the middle of this mess was Yitzhak Isaac Alevi Herzog, who was then the chief rabbi. He was the first chief rabbi of the state of Israel, Rav Herzog. And the first chief rabbi was Rav Kook, but Rav Kook did not live to see the establishment of the state. Kook died in 1935. So in 1948, Rav Herzog was the chief rabbi. And he was a Mizrahi supporter, but he had Kol Yehuda. He was a Talmud Chacham of inordinate magnitude. I mean, a brilliant person. He was called a self-educator. He learned typical yeshiva. He knew everything about everything. He had a PhD from the University of Dublin. He had been chief rabbi of Ireland before coming to Eretz Yisrael. A genius of a person who's science and, I've read his works about Tchelis. He explains the science. In fact, he did his PhD, thesis at the University of Dublin. He called the Hebrew porphyrology, the study of Hebrew colors and so on, Tchelis, Argonim. A genius of a person. Anyway, he had a very close relation with the Aguda, the major rabbi in Eretz Yisrael. He was respected. I mean, when he ran for chief rabbi, there were people who were not happy with it. There were Pashkavilim, those Pashkavilim and those signs that they posted all over Yerushalayim and elsewhere. There were Pashkavilim signs that said, "We will not have a rabbi doctor as chief rabbi." But anyway, he won anyway. Okay, anyway, he was a doctor. Anyway, but he tried to walk the line, and as often happened in the middle, they don't satisfy anybody. So the Mizrahi felt he was supporting boycotting, Tzioni institutions, and the Aguda were not with him. Whatever, nobody was happy. So he was kind of like very much caught in the middle. Okay, but at one point, okay, he did expressing, he did express strong opposition to this type of war games, and it was quite a difficult position to be in. On the 28th of Iyar, June 2nd, 1943, Chaim Weizmann responded to a letter from Yehuda Lev Seltzer, who was in Aguda Rav, saying the following regarding the Tehran children and their education. And I have a copy of it here. I'm reading a copy of it. "I received your letter dated the 2nd of Iyar, 1943, and I, of course, am also irritated, agitated, and anxious regarding the stormy arguments of the issue of the children from Tehran. Yet from afar, it is difficult to learn all the details, and I therefore must not throw myself into the center of this argument." He's not there, he's not going to get involved. He was before the state. I mean, he's in England, right? "I quickly made inquiry with my friends in Jerusalem to advise me regarding all the details, and I'm certain that before I depart for America, I'll be able to advise you regarding my thoughts on the essence of the matter and the steps that I am willing to take. In the meantime, I would ask His Honor to restore calm. As myself, I have great confidence in the integrity of Rabbi Yehuda Leib Fishman, the major Mizrahi leader, changed his name to Maimon Fishman, most of our cook. Anyway, who has been put in charge of the children's education. I also feel that Mrs. Zold, and Henriette is old, herself, a pious and honest woman in the full sense of the word, shall reverently uphold the responsibility placed on her with regard to these children. Please permit me to say that nobody, that to come out publicly against using Zionist funds for this troubling episode, whose details are not known, is a serious misstep, and the Herzog has come out against that forcefully." Herself, again, was then the president of the Agudas Harbonah in the United Union of Orthodox Rabbis of the United States and Canada. And Rav Fishman was a Mizrahi leader. 500 spiritual leaders of Orthodox congregations in America sent telegrams and petitions demanding that the Tehran children be placed under the auspices of Rav Herzog. That was suggested. He's a chief rabbi. Place these children of their education under the everyone trusted of Herzog from all sides, and therefore they placed under the auspices of Herzog for his designee. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Zichrono Bracha, who was then Rosh Hashiva of Tar V'Das, along with Moshe Feinstein, sent a telegram, and I'm reading it here, Western Union telegram. You don't write every word because you pay by the... remember those? No text? Okay. So it says as follows. "Vehement protest, failure, Jewish agency, turn over supervision, chinuch, Jewish orphans in Palestine, to chief rabbinate. All steps must be taken immediately to rectify the situation, to grant these children opportunity to be educated in accordance with Jewish way of life." And that was the letter that they sent. Okay. And Rabbi Yisrael Rosenberg was a major figure also, not as well known. He was involved in the OU and involved in was in NYU and strong support of religious Zionism. Also, you know, I've sent letters of protest. Various others that I have copies of here. Closer to home, Rav Pinchas Teitz, president of the Agudas of the United States in Canada in 1956, founder of J.C. Elizabeth, New Jersey, writes, "The Orthodox of Elizabeth, New Jersey, joined in the demand that the refugee children of Palestine be placed under the supervision of Chief Rabbi Herzog or on the rabbinical board appointed by him," Rav Pinchas Teitz. This is obviously a call to another, what to do about these children. Okay, famous, one of the famous letters from different Jewish leaders. Okay, basically in June of 1944, the Aguda and the Mizrahi got together, okay, and basically decided that, executed a letter of agreement that they came to, that all the arriving children would be divided according to their religious backgrounds, where they came from, okay, and if you can't figure it out, so then there'll be a 70-30 split between Mizrahi and Aguda. They agreed to that, that was the numbers, and so on and so forth. Each side agreed not to propagandize children, they're not going to kidnap any children, and so on. Anyway, eventually the Taran children were absorbed into Jewish life in the Yishuv. Okay, some did not remain religious. Again, this campaign had worked. Many did. Eventually they, you know, grew up, got educated, married, raised families, and so on. 35 of them did not grow up. 35 of them died in the Israeli War of Independence as soldiers, okay? Either as civilians or as soldiers, okay? So, you know, as I said, there is this sort of dark side to it that it became a major issue, and many of these children who had been religious children, you know, lost their connection to Yiddishkeit. We don't know what happens. I mean, I don't know what happened to the subsequent generation. Unfortunately, this was not an isolated incident in that particular regard, okay? Again, just to summarize, you know, almost 1,000 Jewish children went to Tehran, and 80 to 90% by some records came from religious homes, all right? And the goal of the Jewish agency, both in Tehran and eventually in Israel, was non-kosher food and so on and so forth. And according to here, this quote, and I'm not sure where it's from, but it doesn't give a source, but someone, you know, Shomer Tzair, said about the kids that wouldn't eat, quote, "Let one or two die of starvation and the rest will soon forget about kosher food." I don't have an attribution to the quotes, you have to be careful about it. But again, this is what was going on. And again, some of the rabbis said we're not going to fund this, and some of this was a major issue. The truth of the matter is, the Aguda and the Mizrahi had prepared for these kids when they arrived. It wasn't a secret they were coming. Okay, the Aguda prepared 600 places for the children to live. Okay, and they never got those numbers. Okay, only about 30 were placed on good institutions, and you know, others were in Mizrahi. But like I said, Herzog was outraged and so on. And it's really indicative of the major, I guess you call it Kulturkampf, you know, cultural war, for the survival and the religious survival of these children. So that's why I kind of divided the presentation into two. The physical story, a wonderful story. Some Jewish, I mean, not wonderful, many died and they were orphans and so on. It's a tragic story, but in terms of survival from the Holocaust, a terrific story. But, you know, survival at what cost and what really happened and what happened to the, you know, to the religious, it's very difficult, okay? And as I said before, this is something which repeated itself not long thereafter. Another, again, in one sense, of a beautiful story, you know, the operation to get the Jews out of Yemen, magic carpet and so on, so flying carpet, so, you know, the Jews came out of Yemen. But in Yemen, there were religious Jews, and many of them were told to stop being religious. And their payers were cut off. The Yemenites were paying something like the seal they didn't have. And their payers were cut off. Okay? And the parents who wanted to, and they weren't orphans, they were coming with their parents. But their parents were told, you can't register in this school, you can't register in that school, and so on. If you go over here, you're not going to get a job. And you know, in this book, again, it's not really germane to the topic of the Tehran children, but the quote from, this is Rav Kahneman, was the Panamish Rosh Hashiva. Rav Kahneman said when he, this is about the Yemenite, the children. He said, when I met the Yemenite children, he said, I heard the children were benched. They added a harachaman. And a harachaman, I'm reading here in English, I imagine, said, harachaman yanish es tzipora. May he who is merciful revenge us, and he who is merciful punish tzipora. He never heard that before, Rav Kahneman. He thought, okay, it must be some Yemenite minhag, something, you know, it hasn't. Later, he said, I thought this was a Yemenite custom because the children were Yemenite immigrants. Later it became still clear that Tzipora was a Magnichel, cut off their pace. So this story kind of repeated itself, and this was an issue, and I'm not here to talk about politics, but you know, it was a question, and our you know, our survival depends upon the Torah. So Baruch Hashem, now, you know, all these years later, Eretz Yisrael is filled with Torah. In a way, I don't think even the religious ever anticipated or even believed could be possibly possible. You just, you know, it's unbelievable. So it worked out okay. But at the time, there was serious issues, and these children, some of them, were the victims of this. And this is the story of the Taran children. Just to conclude, you know, the West Germans offered reparation money. The Germans offered reparation money for people who were victims of the Holocaust. And there was a whole debate in courts in Israel were the Taran children entitled, not children anymore, they were by then, you know, in the 70s, 80s, or they're still alive. But were the Taran children eligible for this? Originally, they refused, but eventually, they did qualify for German reparations. They were not really officially recognized as Holocaust survivors until 1997. Okay, and in this decision, August 2012, the Tel Aviv District Court awarded 17 million shekel to a group of 217 Taran children that were still alive, and ruled that all of the Taran children were each entitled to compensation payment of 50,000 shekel, with interest in that added up to about 78,000. And that is the story of the Yalvei Teheran. As I said before, a lesser known piece of Jewish history, relatively recent Jewish history. It's not something that's gotten a lot of attention. I didn't get a chance, if those were interested in reaching further, when I was researching online and so on, I came across actually a couple of, I saw links, I didn't get a chance to look on, links on YouTube to a couple of films that have the story, so if you're really interested, you can look further. But again, a bright and a not so bright piece. The bright piece, Jews take care of fellow Jews. Okay, so you have these kids roaming around, whatever it is, and you know they run from Poland, they run to Russia, but the south of Russia, end up in Iran, and the Jewish agency and Jews are at work for saving and bring them to Eretz Yisrael where they belong. On the other hand, we have to, as observant Jews, understand that we have to maintain our fealty to Torah, because just, I guess, saving a life is always important, with or without Torah, but ultimately, once we have our control, we have to see to it, as the Rabbanim, again, American Rabbanim, Dr. Kanusi, Dr. Klein, Dr. Tites, Shalom Rabbanim, you know, sent, did what they could to work with Herzog to eventually, at least for some of the kids, they ended up maintaining the religious connection. It'd be interesting to see what the story is with today, with their descendants, and the Pombo children, I don't know. It's something to look into, but this is the story of the Taran children and their escape from the Holocaust.